This is WMRW LP 94.5 Warren, Vermont, streaming live at WMRW.org. We are an all-volunteer, non-commercial, independent community radio station located right here in the Mad River Valley.
The following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, Roots Work.
Down and down she goes. Somebody gonna come up and ask her to live happily ever after, Miss Amanda Jones. On and on she goes, little Miss Amanda Jones. I said on and on and on and on, just watch her as she goes. Don't wanna say it very obviously, but she's living on a melody, Miss Amanda.
Good afternoon, Mad River Valley. We're just getting settled. I'm going to put on Hal for another minute, and then I'll be back. Good afternoon, Mad River Valley. This is Jerry with the 5-H show. 5-H is health, happiness, humor, harmony, and humanity.
Wonderful.
But this, we're doing a series. I don't know if any of you have been listening to interview all the candidates who are running to represent Washington 2 District, which is us. Warren, Waitsfield, Faiston, Duxbury, and Moortown. I got them all, right?
You sure did.
And today my guest is my third candidate, Dara Torrey, and she's actually currently our representative, and she's running again for re-election. And thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
It's great to just have everybody's perspective, and you get a whole hour to answer questions. And
wonderful.
Put you on the hot seat.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Would you like to just tell a little bit about your background before we get started with questions?
Sure. I moved to the Valley in 2000. And with a baby and a dog and my husband, and lived here just for not even a year. We had a really hard time finding housing.
Where did you move from?
From Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
So
that's a huge move.
It was a big move, and I feel so connected to a lot of the young families here now because I remember my own journey, and I know just how hard it is to find childcare and housing, and working on those two issues as an incumbent has just been an amazing experience. I've learned so much. There's still a lot to do, despite what we've accomplished. And why I was drawn to run in the first place, I think, is from just having been embraced by this community and our ethic of stewardship and of everybody showing up for each other and trying new things, because we really need everyone to bring what they can to our community. We're small. And so I think for me, I got drawn into public service through being involved in the Moortown Elementary School and getting involved in a
Were
sidewalk project.
Were you a board
project.
Member?
I was the PTO president.
Oh, wow.
And
that's exciting.
It was great because we got to work on all the enrichment stuff, the natural science program. And one day this letter came about a Safe Routes to School program. Safe Routes to School. And it was a federally funded program with state chapters looking at why are kids not walking to school?
That's
as
a
much
great
as they
question.
Used to. I know. And I loved it. And that kind of led me into the world of planning. So I got involved in the Planning Commission.
What did they come up with why kids don't walk to school? I mean, I see people drive their kids down the driveway.
I know.
To wait for the school bus.
Safety is a big thing for our generation.
So people are just afraid.
That's part of it. Some of it's the lack of pedestrian infrastructure.
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with the fact that we developed outside of, you know, compact development. Sometimes it's concern about the bus and things that could happen on the bus. You know, there's a lot of reasons that people might not try it. But for us, it was really about, you know, are there safe biking routes? Mm-hmm. How are we doing on sidewalks and trails? And one of the best parts was going out with a active transportation person who, you know, we organized the community to meet and actually walk. Mm-hmm. And look at all the different ways to access our school. And I know Warren did it, too.
Yeah.
So that was really eye-opening for me. And then we eventually got our sidewalk grant awarded. And so we actually have sidewalks in our village.
Huh. Is that how Moortown has sidewalks?
Because believe it or not, it was somebody on the PTO.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But, I mean, it was years in the making, like back in the day, like 20 years before my time, there had been a federal funding opportunity, and we weren't able to get it. But so, you know, you pick up where other people leave off, right?
Yeah. Okay, so since you're an incumbent, I'm going to do it a little bit differently than I've done, because the other three candidates are not incumbents. They're running for the first time.
Right.
But so I'd like to ask you, you've been there 2 years now?
Yes.
2 years. What have your priorities been as far as bills that have either gotten passed or not gotten passed, but the ones that you felt were most important?
Yes.
And while you're answering, I'm going to take my sweater off because it is hot
it
in
is
here.
Warm in here. So I went campaigning, just like all of the candidates are doing right now, and used that as my opportunity to find out what are the big issues for our community. And, you know, they're pretty much still the big issues. Housing, childcare, climate action. So for me, I felt really good about going into the first session knowing what was most important, and also while I was there learning where are the opportunities, because, you know, there's the will, but then there's the way. And fortunately, I happened to serve when the Let's Grow Kids campaign was pretty mature and had developed this childcare approach to really meet the market failure that we've been facing around childcare. So that was extremely exciting, because my very first time ever in the State House was many years ago, and I was sitting in the chamber, and I was actually sitting next to Let's Grow Kids advocates who are wearing t-shirts. That was years ago.
Yeah.
And it made me realize, like, a lot of the big things we do, they don't happen quickly. A lot of times people are thinking, oh, you know, Democrats in the State House are being rash. But these are like many, many year, multi-session, lots of compromise, lots of consensus building has gone into a lot of these big bills that we pass. So that was historic. I loved being part of that. And then I got assigned to the Environment and Energy Committee. House okay. representatives, they serve on one committee. Mm-hmm. Senators serve on two. And so
I didn't realize that. Yeah, so you get one committee.
You get one committee, so you get more time on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been sort of an issue because we can produce so much in the House, and then the Senate has to get it because of crossover.
Right.
So there's a little pipeline problem sometimes. but in that committee, I got to work on land use, which was really very near and dear, having been on a planning commission and having worked for the Mad River Valley Planning District. I understood.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I worked with Josh Schwartz.
Oh, okay.
I started as an intern, and then I was I don't even know what I was, a planning coordinator, I think, for a couple of years. And
yeah, he just won, I think, Person of the Year.
Rotary Person of the Year. I'm a Rotarian, too.
Oh, good.
Got to give a plug to the Rotary. So we worked this year on the Act 250 modernization bill. Mm-hmm. And we worked on a big conservation bill last year, the 30 by 30, 50 by 50 bill, which would set in motion how could we accomplish the conservation that we need to really protect biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of biodiversity experts right here in our community and a lot of amazing conservation achievements. So this would be building up a statewide pathway to accomplishing that, which is so important as we approach our housing situation. We need to know where to build, where do we want concentrated development, and where are those most special, fragile areas where we don't.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like a major focus over both years of my first term.
Do you think Act 250 works well or needs to be
I've
tweaked?
I've learned
or?
So much about Act 250.
Yeah.
So Act 250, my big takeaway is that overall, yes, it has worked well in making Vermont look the way it looks now,
mm-hmm.
protecting Vermont and keeping the more compact approach, less sprawl, preventing some projects that would have been very problematic in different areas. But what's been really important, I didn't realize, was that in the past, the trigger was about the project and the scale of it.
Mm.
And now, with the new legislation we passed, it's really about the place. So it's location-based. It's about, is it one of those special areas that are very fragile? Is it an area that's already developed, that has infrastructure, that has planning capacity, that already has a lot of strong local regulations?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe those are areas that won't need to trigger Act 250, because Act 250 is expensive and it causes delays in time, you know, to get the projects out. I heard some pretty tough stories from folks here in our community that have run into Act 250 issues. And so I think the overhaul was really needed on both the making it work better, and also another component was the governance side of it, how it operates.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned a lot about that, and that's sort of still evolving, but it's going to become a more professionalized board.
Is there ever any, I know one of my biggest concerns, and I've lived here for 21 years now, and I moved here partly for a lot of the same reasons you did, but I just love having the farms.
I love to
be able to go to Pat Livingston and get meat and get eggs. And he's my age, like 65, 66 years old, and his kids don't want to do it. And the farm, at this point, what's going to happen? And he certainly isn't alone. And I'm just wondering if there's ever any connection, like Act 250, they build in something that would really help the farmers or some kind of, I don't know what the answer is, honestly.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's a big deal. You know, farming is changing, and what do they call it? When you develop other businesses on your farm, so you're doing value-added farming, you're producing products. You have a farm stand with food. You're selling things. There's ways to actually do more, and some of that is much more appealing to the younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I got involved in when I was working on the Act 250 bill was the request by some from the Ag Commissioner, actually, that there be a little more leeway for how farms operate those mm-hmm. types of businesses. And I was alarmed to find out, because I'm a baker and everyone knows I love donuts, right? Dara, have donuts with Dara. I was shocked to find out that you're not allowed to, we were prohibiting the ability to sell baked goods unless they were baked with the flour from the farm and like eggs from the farm. And I was just like, it felt unreasonable to me.
Yeah.
So that was like, I got that in.
Well, that's good.
Got the goods in there. I think that thinking about how to support our farms is a huge effort, and we have a lot more to do. And as you know, in terms of one of the big issues I heard from lots of people in this community of beekeepers and farmers and everybody who's interested in thriving was the neonic bill. The neonic bill was there are these seeds that farmers use that are treated with a pesticide to keep the seed viable and that it really mm-hmm. sprouts and everything. It's important. But they've learned that some of the pesticide that's used is actually toxic to bees and birds.
I do remember reading about that.
We worked on legislation that would replace the type of pesticide, take that out of the picture, and align with the New York market
mm-hmm.
because New York is already doing this. So that was I heard from so many people to support that bill.
Okay, I want to get into the elephant in the room: taxes.
Education.
But, yeah,
yes,
but before we do, since we're on the housing, I'll just mm-hmm. have, because I think I told you I emailed a bunch of people who I know and yes. asked if they had any priorities that they wanted to have addressed with these interviews I'm doing. And of course, the number one was taxes, but mm-hmm. it was also short-term rentals.
Yes.
And how you feel that should go in the term of fees or regulations. And if someone local like owns a house and puts a little rental on their property to help them pay their exorbitant taxes, how you feel that should work?
I know a lot of people that are doing that. They're using little extra space they have in their house, or they put a accessory dwelling unit on their property and they're doing the short-term rental, and it is helping them pay their property tax bill. And that seems fine to me. Mm-hmm. I think the more alarming thing is the empty second home that's being used, or these investment properties, because that has all sorts of impacts on our communities. You know, that means those people, there's no community member there anymore. And we do have a housing crisis. So I was really impressed with all the work that the Warren Planning Commission's been working on. I think the first step of having a registration process, I didn't realize this until I served, but we do not have any registry for rentals in the state. Mm. And we have a housing crisis.
Yeah.
And we have public emergencies like flooding events. And we don't know this stuff.
Mm.
So it's really important to have that registry. I think that's a good first step. And I know that's something that they're going to be pursuing in Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see it more broadly for all rentals.
For all rentals, but do you see a two different levels, like one maybe for homeowners and local residents and one for out of state?
Well, the registry is just, letting the state know you exist.
Okay, I see.
Knowing where those properties are, where mm-hmm. people are either living on a long-term lease or a short-term one, so mm-hmm. that we have that information.
I see.
In terms of collecting fees, we did raise some taxes on short-term rentals this year, and that was partly the big revenue gap that we're facing in the state, and looking for ways that we could do that, and knowing that a lot of our lodging properties have already had to meet a pretty high bar.
Yeah.
That, the short-term rentals don't need to. So That happened.
That was kind of across the board. If you do a short-term rental, if it's a room in your house.
The seller pays.
Okay.
The renter pays this additional fee. And I don't, you know, there were some concerns from people about that. Like, is it going to impact our business? But it seems like most people are coming here because they want to be here.
Yeah.
They're coming for a wedding. They're doing whatever they're doing. And that little incremental increase isn't going to shut the door on their choice. But there is more work to do as we think about second homes in general, as we think about, how do we raise revenue to support housing initiatives? There could be a role for short-term rental fees in that. So I look forward to starting with knowing the lay of the land, like how many units are we talking about? There is some information out there. There's a, what are they called? The Vermont Short-Term Rental Alliance. They have a lot of good information on their website.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, and we know, I think we're learning more, but that's just a very important area because we do have, we have a lot of people now who need to decide, do I want to have an accessory dwelling unit, like an in-law apartment, so that I could have a long-term renter, somebody that's going to work in our community, or do I want to have this short-term income, or do I want to do a little bit of both? Maybe I'll do it for a little while, and then I'll do the long-term. And then we can think about, you know, how do we incentivize people so that they could do the long-term choice, which is the better choice in terms of housing?
Yeah.
Are there ways to entice people to make it easier to take the risk that having a long-term renter presents to you? Because it is a real risk.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't want to be that type of landlord. So I think there's a lot of creative thinking out there. The Mad River Valley Housing Coalition has been doing some thinking on that. And I guess I see the state role as really supporting what is going to work best on the local level.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thanks. Okay. Moving on to the biggie.
Yeah.
I guess my first question is, what do you see created this huge jump in taxes from last year to this year?
Yeah. So I understand there are like multiple things. One was the fact that we had extra money from the feds during the pandemic that I think they were called ESSER funds.
ESSER funds?
ESSER, E-S-S-R. I'm not sure what it stands for.
Whatever.
But what it did was it allowed the schools to build up staffing to provide the extra services they needed to during the pandemic. And so that money ran out. And there, basically, it was kind of padding us, so to speak, as taxpayers, because the school budgets were kind of able to just do their thing without really needing anything from us. Then when that money went away, that created a loss for them.
Well, the extra services that were created because this money was available, are they services that you feel have made a positive difference in education for kids?
Well, that what we are hearing is some of the services needed to continue because those needs are still there. So, for example, around mental health delivery services. Other things didn't need to be needed. And, you know, our local budget took out a number of staff positions that we passed. But that was one piece. The other piece was health care costs. As you know, those have been rising, really rising. So that affects school budgets really directly because they have a lot of staff who get benefits. And that was big. I think it was 16%. It was a high jump. And then, there is the question of the serving the needs of students for their mental health. Should that money come from the Ed Fund? Should it come from something else? That's an area that we need to explore because those were real costs. Special ed costs went up. There had been a lot of learning loss during the pandemic. So, we did have an economic shock. a social shock.
So the money that we got, you're the first person I've interviewed, I think, that I can recall gave me a concrete answer to that question.
About the ESSER?
About what caused the increase from last year to this year, because, you know, there's all these answers.
Well, that was part of it. Like I said, it was multifactorial.
But the pandemic money, was that covering the increase in healthcare costs?
Well, it was taking pressure off the other parts of the budget.
I see.
That makes sense. We were able to have universal school meals during the pandemic. And, of course, everybody loved that so much that they came to the State House and said, let's make that ongoing. And, of course, now that's become a little controversial because of the budget crunch we're in. But I understand that, you know, that's made a lot of things better in terms of more people are eating, more students are eating the good food, the local food that we prepare. And it's drawing down more federal dollars because when you have more people eating, you have more, some portion of them are eligible for the federal subsidy.
How do you think, Act 60, and I realize this isn't just from last year to this year because it's been in place since what?
The 90s.
Yeah. What do you think of it? And just briefly,
I had to get up to speed on all this because I didn't see any of this coming this year. Like last year, we focused on all the stuff we focused on, and education and finance wasn't really top of mind for people. And I don't have a background in that. I was just a taxpayer like everybody else, always mystified by how much I ended up having to pay and always being very confused about the formula. Like I never really understood it. My husband was on the school board and so I kind of experienced some of it vicariously through him. But what I learned is that we do not have our federal constitution does not have a right to equal education. There is no right. In 50 years ago, there was a Supreme Court case that said that clearly. So then there's the state constitutions that say different things. And ours, our state, has a constitutional amendment piece that says that we do owe Vermonters equal access to education. So we got sued, like many other states, back in the day, and that's where Act 60 came from.
I didn't realize. It was evolved from a lawsuit.
It evolved from a lawsuit.
I didn't know that.
So, you know, and so it was trying to figure out how you take this very inequitable pot, which property taxes are by nature inequitable because people, the value of their homes and in their communities varies. There's wealthy areas and not wealthy areas. So, you know, Act 260, it created this very complex way of trying to ensure that there's enough money for even schools that don't really have a lot of wealth in their community.
Yeah. I think most people are supportive of that. I am. And, you know,
we
I never minded
absolutely.
So much paying, making sure kids are educated. I mean, who doesn't want that? Everybody wants that. But I guess the problem is when you look at how much we pay in taxes, we're what, number two in the country? And our education is, I don't know, what is it, 40 or 42 or something? We're way down. So how is it that we're paying so much, but we don't have the quality of education for all students? You know, something seems to be not working.
It's a really painful problem for me because, you know, I'm a huge supporter of our schools, our families, our students, and I do think everybody deserves a quality education in this country, and I do wish that there was more federal funding for education. So I think that I understand that these funding mechanisms become unwieldy at times and need to be revamped, and that's where we're at. I mean, I think we've been here for a while, but now I think there is a lot of consensus that it's completely broken because it's not actually this particular experience of seeing budgets go down all over, Morrisville, Barrie, Slate Valley. These were budgets that were lean as can be, and those were districts that were supposed to be benefiting from the new weighting system, the one that actually didn't benefit us. And then to see that...
And the weighting system is where some students get more points than others in
the
tax.
Because the cost of educating different kinds of students was trying to be accounted for, and that was in 2022, before my time. So It's not working.
It's just not working.
I think we can all agree it's not working. And that's why what we do next. We do need to come up with a new funding formula, but we also need to look at our actual cost containment strategies, because that's what you're referring to, the fact that if you don't manage those costs, taxpayers end up paying a lot. So we have to look at our education system and figure out, are there efficiencies that we could be pursuing? Are there ways to, we're already on the road to being able to share services regionally. We passed legislation last year to do that. Boards of Cooperative Education, it's called. Finding out, like, what are those most expensive student services that are happening and figuring out how to make them less so. And then, you know, people have looked at the idea of consolidation. That's going to be totally a local conversation as well. But apparently there are some high schools that have fewer than 100 students. So some of the thought of merging districts, maybe. There's a lot out there, and that's why I'm asking people for patience. I know everybody feels like you can't be patient when you get a bill that big. But to do the kind of systemic change that we need to do is going to take a little time. I think that there are some shorter term things that can happen that can maybe lessen the blow next year.
Such as?
Well, I mean, there could be, the funding mechanism suggestions are going to be coming in December. So there will be, you know, I'm not on one of the committees that gets their hands into this. It will be the Ways and Means in the House that does it. And then the Education Committee will be working on the system, the big picture system of education in the state. But I think all of us, if I'm back there, if the new candidates get elected, everybody's going to be involved.
Focused.
And advocating for their districts, because our district is has been hurt.
Yeah.
And
I
don't want that to continue. I want it to be fair.
You know, I was listening to Vermont Viewpoint this morning, Kevin Ellis, and he was interviewing a woman. I think her name was Alex McLean. She's a Vermonter anyway. She's connected to politics somehow. It might be national.
Okay.
Because I think if she was with the state, you might know who she is. But she said that closing schools would do nothing to help the budget. Do you think that?
I mean, it's hard to imagine that in the sense we have so much aging infrastructure. You know, our schools are old, and some of them are contaminated with PCBs. And, you know, I think none of them have gotten adequate state support. But I think that was back during Governor Douglas that they stopped funding school construction. So schools haven't been able to maintain their buildings. It does seem to me that if you had fewer buildings, at least those costs could go down.
And wouldn't it create less administrative infrastructure? Like,
well, that's the question. Like, that's why they're trying to take a systemic approach to this reform, because it's more than buildings. It's also, like you say, it's the administration. And, you know, we are a small state. You know, people have talked about Hawaii. Hawaii only has one school district.
There you go. How many do we have?
A ton. So, you know, because we have our very strong local town identities. And I think that's what's being challenged by a lot of forces right now, both economic, that you're seeing with schools, but also with climate. You know, we're finding that our little town road crews are being asked to deal with issues much, much bigger than ever. And so we are, as a state, moving in a direction where I think we have to understand how to work more regionally. We're already finding that with FEMA, they don't know how to deal with us because we don't have county government. So there is a study happening right now that is looking at regional governance, what that could look like. And that has, I believe, could have some impact, not just on our resilience. I know you want to talk about that today, too.
Yeah.
But also potentially in the education realm.
Okay. I'm talking to Dara Torrey. She is our current representative for District 2, and Washington District 2, I should say. And she's running again, and the election is November 5th, so we're trying to get perspectives from all the candidates. And, yeah, I just want to run one more thing by you with the taxes, and then we'll get into resilience.
Yes.
Someone I had gotten an email from, he moved here from California. Well, he moved from California to Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. In California, he said they came up with a plan where there was a 2% cap on tax increases.
Yeah.
Then when he was in Massachusetts, he said they had a 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Would you favor that? Would you support that?
I would want to learn a little more about it. You know, we have to be able to, you know, if there's inflation, if there's different costs that happen and you have a cap, then, you know, you are looking at diminishing your schools. So I think that it's important that we understand what adequacy is for our schools and really commit to what that's going to look like. But I do wonder when you have home values appreciating like they did here. There are other techniques that are out there for when you have a reassessment and suddenly your home's worth so much that you don't get hit all at once, that you have like a slower.
But that would solve that problem, wouldn't it, if we had a cap?
Well,
percentage?
I mean, like, I think caps are one option, but there's others. So I'm looking forward to learning more about all the options because some might work better for Vermont than others. I mean, my friend who lives in Melrose, Massachusetts, has been struggling because she's very involved in her school and their town budget and school budget went down. And so they tried to override with, you know, because of the cap, you have to get a townwide vote. And they weren't able to do that. And so all sorts of massive cuts are happening. And that's tough.
Yeah, yeah.
But my question is to the professionals out there and the experts, because I'm not one of them, you know, what are ways to protect property owners without sacrificing your schools? Because what could happen to public education is that people who can afford private will go that route and we'll be left with even smaller public schools with much less rich learning environments. And, you know, we have to avoid that. So I like the idea of doing this work that we're doing with the funding and the system in mind so that we pick the best choice for our students and for our homeowners and taxpayers.
What do you think of vouchers? Voucher system?
I have heard mixed things.
Yeah.
I've heard that the programs end up passing costs on to taxpayers, that there's less accountability, that the outcomes aren't so great in some states. So
this is there's places where the voucher system's been in.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to look up a state I was just hearing about is Arizona. They've got a voucher battle going on right now.
Huh.
And so, you know, I think that was one of the things that scared a lot of people about the choice in the Agency of Ed commissioner.
Yeah.
Because of her background and not really being sure, like, is this part of the vision the governor has for our education system?
Yeah.
Another big potential threat to public ed.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I don't have kids, so I don't have a horse in the race, so I haven't paid as much attention as I should until this year when I got my tax bill. Then I said, gee, maybe I should pay more attention to this.
I know.
Because I got to move.
I think everybody's going to have to give a little bit. Everybody's going to have to give a little bit so that we can manage these costs.
Yeah.
And I believe that can be done.
Okay. All right. So if we move on to the second biggest topic I heard from people is... again, I guess it's tied to money, but is I guess it's the S5, the heat affordability.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have the impression that this is really going to create a financial hardship for people.
Yeah.
Are you supportive of that bill?
Well, I can give you a little information because that was in my committee. So I got to
Oh, okay,
I got
great.
To hear from all kinds of witnesses. I have to say it was extremely complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I know about it, too, because I work in the clean energy policy field. And one of my colleagues helped design this idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very familiar with it, but I'm not super comfortable with it because it's super complicated.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that the idea behind it, well, first, to get to your question, your immediate question about cost impacts, of course, that is paramount. The thinking behind the program is, can we transition off of fossil fuels in a managed way and ensure that people who are on low or fixed incomes have the ability to make the change just like anyone else can, so that you don't end up with who's left getting propane? The least able to afford it. Because what mm-hmm. happens when fewer people are buying it? It's going to become more expensive. So it's the idea behind the Affordable Heat Act was this way to have fossil fuel importers have skin in the game to fund more options for people to heat their homes with heat pumps, you know, what do you call the wood stoves, but also the other kind, the pellet stoves.
Yeah.
Weatherization, we need it desperately. That's like the first thing you have to do, right? You have to plug the leaks in the house before you invest in new heating. And so that would be a durable source of funding. And basically, it's asking the fossil fuel importers to either, and this is just heating fuel I'm talking about, to either provide those services of installing the heat pumps, mm-hmm. or they could contract with someone else to do it, or they would just pay a fee. And this would all be in this market. I think this market concept is confusing and hard to imagine mm-hmm. for a lot of us. And in fact, right now, the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, they are the regulator for our energy, our electricity sector, and they are the ones that have been looking at this proposed program and developing what they call a draft rule that would say how this could look in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And that would then go to the legislature in 2025 and be voted on. So that's what the Affordable Heat Act did, was set that program in motion in terms of what would it look like? How would it affect fuel prices for people? And then, you know, how well can the market meet the demand? And, you know, it's a whole lot of things that have to be studied to say, is this a realistic pathway?
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a ton of work going on about it, and we're going to be hearing more. I think the draft rule just came out, the yeah. initial draft rule. So really
good.
The takeaway I want everybody to hear, because I do hear from people, and I'm knocking on doors and I'm talking to people and I see it on Front Porch Forum, there is no accurate estimate right now of what it would cost. Like, it's not going to be a $4 increase in your propane bill. Like, that, everything you're hearing like that, and maybe you're even getting inserts in your bill that are saying stuff like that, none of that is actually true, because that information is not available because the program's not real yet.
Yeah.
But it's a real concern. I have no question that that is a very important concern. And it may be possible that we have to explore a different way to help people get off fossil fuels, have more options, and do it in an equitable way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very open to whatever options are out there. That's one idea, but there could be others. The important thing is to do it in a planned way instead mm-hmm. of letting it be random, and to try to really build the workforce and help these fuel businesses transition, because we need that workforce. They need to have sustained business mm-hmm. and meet their customers where their customers want to be. And that's one of the things I really heard in committee, was just these heating contractors, you know, they want to work, they want to put reliable equipment in their customers' homes. They want people to get warm when mm-hmm. they want to be warm. They don't want to hear from people in the middle of the night with problems, right?
Right.
Do they really care if it's fossil fuel that's source, you know, the source of the equipment?
Yeah.
Like, it's not really about the the source. It's about how well is the equipment working, how much does it cost, can it be installed affordably. Like, all of that is really what matters, I think, to the businesses. And a lot of people have already started doing a lot of heat pump installs. So they're already benefiting from the fact that we have this new technology and that we have choices that help us heat and cool, you know, with one appliance. Yeah. So, you know, but then on the other hand, there's people that feel like this is an existential threat to my business model. So, you know, it's understandable that it's been a very contentious idea.
Yeah. That kind of segues into, and I'm at ground zero with understanding this stuff, but I do like to look at both sides of something.
Yes.
And so the other side, not only the cost, but it's what difference is it going to make? And is, if you have all electric, like let's say everything's electric, we have electric cars and electric heat pumps and we run our lives on electric, is that really helping that much to save the planet? And what about the third world countries where all these minerals are getting mined from and the slavery that's being used for that? And what if there was a power outage and your whole world is electric? You can't even drive your car.
Yeah.
So there's those issues. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you've ever, those come into play in your committee.
I do also hear that from people. They say, because they know Vermont has been a leader on energy. You know, we're this tiny state, but we have some of the best energy efficiency in the country. Like, we're like number two in the country.
Because
we planned ahead. Because we said, how do we avoid costly infrastructure upgrades we have to make because our energy needs are going up? Instead, well, let's shrink the pie. Let's use less energy and do it by using more efficient equipment, right?
Yeah.
So we did that investment. We asked utility ratepayers, all of us who pay electric bills, we asked them, pay a little in, and we're going to have a program, and we're going to make it easier for people to get better equipment in their homes and businesses. Mm-hmm. And Efficiency Vermont has done that for us. And as a result, they say that we've saved like $3 billion and our state has lower electricity rates than other states in New England. I think that, you know, we have some deep policy innovation that we've been willing to do in Vermont to save money. And so the idea is, why would we not do that for climate? And some people say, well, Vermont's so small and isn't responsible for very much. And what difference is it going to make? And I think that that's a good question, because I know you're someone who thinks a lot about health. And I do, too, because honestly, our indoor air quality, and we spend a lot of time in our homes, that's something that nobody really knows much about. Like, as homeowners, you don't find that out. You don't have anything measuring, right, telling you that your indoor air quality is bad. But it turns out, you know, combustion is bad for air quality. And whenever we're cooking, whenever we're burning wood, whenever we're burning our gas stove, cooking food, all of that stuff, there are emissions as a result. And I'm personally very intrigued in finding out, like, what are the health benefits of getting off of combustion? Because, you know, for some people who have asthma or a heart condition, it can make a real difference. It's not good for children to be exposed to that stuff. So, you know, if there are benefits, then beyond the big global picture, that's a moral question, really. Like, when you know morally that you're polluting in a way that's going to have an impact on future generations, that's a question. But in terms of practicality, there are so many co-benefits besides the greenhouse gas emission reduction that I think that that it does make a lot of sense.
And the mineral mining, has your committee ever discussed that issue?
Not a whole lot. I mean, that's about the batteries and the solar panels.
Well, batteries and everything, I guess.
Fortunately, there's the thing about technology is it just keeps changing, and there's already a new type of battery they're looking at that wouldn't involve those minerals.
So, lithium?
Okay. You know, it's something, it's important to think about that. But I do see how technology just keeps going.
What
we can do in terms of policy is really not get in the way. That's what I see. How do we make the most of the opportunity we have to give the good choices and to get the better choices out there faster? Because time is important right now.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between oil and propane as far as clean energy?
Which burns cleaner or dirtier? I want to say, I think that propane might burn a little cleaner than oil, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, I've heard that.
There's a great resource. The Energy Action Network, EAN.org, has a lot of information.
But propane wouldn't be one of the choices for the
good question. Actually, yes, renewable fuels, they're calling it. So I think Bourne's is already making these.
Oh.
So it's sort of like you lower the content of the carbon in your product by other ways. And that's one of the strategies that would be covered by the Clean Heat Standard, which is the policy.
That's good to know.
We've been discussing.
Because I think that's helpful.
Yeah, it's a transition, right? We're in a transition.
Yeah.
And that's a step that's, incrementally better. And why not try all the steps?
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Flood resiliency. They just, in Moortown, didn't Moortown just have some kind of conference about it or something? Some kind of walk or something that you guys are going to discuss what to do?
Yeah, there's a, we got hit pretty hard.
Yeah.
Just like Facetown.
Again.
Our steep roads this time really got nailed. And then, of course, the steep hillsides are a problem. Landslides and just the volume of water that can come down and be very damaging. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have already done a lot of work in our community because we have Friends of the Mad River and we've had this Ridge to River initiative that's been going on for years that has really brought a lot of our towns together and our road crews together to do best practice thinking. We have the Storm Smart program to help homeowners manage water on their property. So we're kind of ahead of the game locally. But in terms of, the state, we kind of do know what we need to do for resilience. We know that it's the floodplain restoration, limiting development in river corridors, wetland protections. The state's been doing a lot on that, and we're going to up our game because our risk has been upped, as we know. The severity of the storms we're dealing with, the damage, has necessitated that we do more. So we did do a lot in the Flood Safety Act that got passed last year. But I think that there's still more, there's a lot we can do to protect public safety. Preventing building on steep slopes is really important. I know it's hard when you own land like that and you don't understand why, but look at what's happening in North Carolina. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. And I feel like
Vermont and
North Carolina are good examples because the mountainous area there, they don't have state regulations like we have. They haven't had any of the important things to require building codes and keep up with, they don't have steep slope legislation and all the stuff that, I think some people have rolled their eyes over the years, like, why does Vermont do so much? But we actually protect people and property better than some places, and we can do more.
Have you do you know anything about dredging? I don't want to put you on the spot because I don't. I
do.
Keep wondering. Is
I
it
mean,
good
I've
or bad?
Learned a little bit just through, the dialogue. It's been an ongoing thing. I think it was just in the paper this week.
It was. Yeah, there was.
I think what I hear from the experts, and I'm not one of them, is that there are cases, because again, this is location specific, context specific. So you can't just say dredging is okay, or you can't say it can never be used. It depends, right, on what you're talking about, where you're talking about. So I think there are specific applications of dredging where it might make sense, But generally, it's not considered, it's considered a Band-Aid, generally, that causes downstream problems. So you just made your area better off.
Yeah.
But guess who's going to have to deal with that extra volume of water? So yeah. That's one of the things that's so, that's one of the reasons that we're looking at doing more statewide regulation, because of our interconnectedness on this issue. And if one town has regulations but another doesn't, where's the protection?
Mm-hmm. And like you said, I guess it depends. I mean, again, I'm at ground zero, but the area makes so much sense. Maybe it
it's
would be good
the
in
context.
Some places,
yeah.
but not others
yeah.
for whatever
and
reasons. And
we know we are so lucky in Vermont that we have these, you know, really committed agencies and nonprofits and specialists who are right there and willing to help brainstorm, like, what do we do with this particular problem right here? How do we protect the landowner right there? And there's, you know...
as far as you know, being on the inside track, being a representative, mm-hmm. they're not ruling out dredging, like, just say, no, it's bad.
Yeah, like I said, it's when you
table.
Have a problem and you're looking at putting in new strategies for that particular area to prevent damage in the future, you're going to get a lot of minds and people to help you think
ideas.
It through.
Yeah.
So dredging could be on the table for a particular issue, but it could also not make sense, and you would need to know why, right?
Yeah. All right. Affordable Heat Act. Abortion. Where do you stand on that? I just had a few questions. I realize it seems to me like it's kind of settled in the state of Vermont, I'm assuming, but...
we're protected in Vermont because we did the...
And you're
Reproductive Liberty
that.
Act.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's health care.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening around the country and in other states is just so alarming. And the rollback of Roe v. Wade has just had all sorts of impacts. You know, things that are supposed to be between a doctor and a patient, there's a reason for that.
Right.
You know, this is just not a place where I think government belongs. So I'm grateful for the work that has happened, the proactive work in Vermont.
Yeah. And health choice. I mean, you have the right to choose whether you want to complete a pregnancy. What about other things like vaccinations?
I know that's near and dear to your heart and others. I know there's some people in the community who have brought that subject up and have visited the state house and are putting a lot of effort into it.
They are.
For me, you know, I do think about community health and public health, and it's one of those situations where you have to balance the individual and the community. So, you know, I do want to see children go to school who are vaccinated, because there are always, you have to be aware that there could be a child that has a compromised immune system and is more at risk. So I do believe that vaccines are important for public health. And I understand where the idea of health choice comes, and I understand where the lack of trust comes in terms of, does our country really protect our health very well as consumers? I would say not really. We know that there's all kinds of things we don't learn are toxic till they're out there. And other countries like Europe have a much more protective approach. So I understand how people would feel like, I don't know if I can trust that the vaccine is safe for me. And that's a real conundrum, because there are reasons why you shouldn't feel trusting. There are reasons for that. But I guess for me, I've had a lot of vaccinations to this point.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a complication. And I've seen just amazing health outcomes around the world from vaccinations. So it's, you know, taking that policy perspective of the larger lens of public health versus the individual is an easier choice for me than some people.
Yeah, I guess that's a whole like couple hour show to go into all of that.
And I know, I mean, I've talked to people in this community who have done so much scientific research and they really feel so strongly about it. And it's tough.
Yeah. And I guess just the science aside, just the what you see around you, it's been what we heard for the last 3 years that just wasn't the case and that kind of thing, you know. And so when it comes to a mandate, when they're telling you something that proves to be wrong, I guess I'm wondering if they did that again, would you support that kind of a mandate? Or,
well, you mean wrong in what way?
The mRNA injections didn't stop transmission and didn't stop getting COVID. People got COVID even though they were vaccinated. It didn't stop transmission. In the beginning, they told us that's why we had to get vaccinated. Right. So if that situation...
I guess I understood it to mean that you would be less likely to have a bad outcome.
Just you have
like
to go back.
When you get a flu shot, right? It's. I mean, I see it as very similar to the flu shot idea, which is, you know, what is it now? This year, they say it's going to be like 30-something percent effective because it's already been down in the southern hemisphere. And so you're just hoping to mitigate the worst of the, you know, types of illnesses you can get and complications.
To your point about caring about your community rather than the individual, if it doesn't stop transmission, how is it helping the community?
It's reducing death rates.
But that, again, it's a personal thing.
Well,
right? I mean,
fatalities are, you know, looked at, you know, it's it's pretty important that you, if you have a strategy that can help keep people alive, it's important to do it, right?
Yeah, but still back to your point about community. I know we're at 1 o'clock and we got to go.
Are we? But, oh my gosh, where did that hour go?
It went. Yeah, maybe we'll save this.
Yeah,
maybe
this is,
after the election we can talk about
how,
if you ever want to get into it, it's pretty,
It's one of those. Sounds like you've been reading some different stuff, but I am
read,
happy
like
to
I
talk
said,
more with you.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
I read both sides of almost anything because, maybe because I'm a Libra and it's the balance, but I don't, whenever I read one thing, I always say, well, what's the other side to that?
That's a really
that's
good quality
I,
to have.
Yeah. It, well, in the beginning of the pandemic, I was okay, and making masks. And and then I started to think and study and took a virology course. And
read
and, well, I didn't know. I was at ground zero, and I thought, I need to learn about this.
Yeah.
And that's how I came about thinking the way I think. But it's a different conversation.
It is.
Anyway, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
And not only that, I learned a lot from this conversation. So it's great.
I mean, that's the best part of being a legislator is you're in constant learning mode. You're learning about your constituents and what they value. You're learning about what's working in other parts of Vermont.
Yeah, let me just say you're listening to WMRW LP Warren 94.5 FM, streaming at WMRW.org. I've been talking to Dara Torrey. She's our representative currently, and she's running for re-election in November along with three other candidates. I'll have the fourth candidate, John Burns, on next Friday. And thank you so much for coming
in.
My pleasure.
Really, this was really fun.
Yeah, it was.
Thanks, Jerry.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Gary Jackson will be in at 2 o'clock with Weekend Warm-Up. Play some great music. And have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy that spectacular weather out there. And I'll see you next week.